And welcome back to yet another rousing episode of Baseball is Dumb, the podcast where we talk about the dumbest stories from America's dumbest pastime. As always, I am your host, Ian, and with me, as always, the man who I would binge watch Austin Powers with any day of the week.
Aww.
It's Johnny. What's up, bud?
Hey, that's so nice of you to say, considering that most of those movies are bad, but...
They are.
They are fun. They are indeed very fun.
Yeah, when I was rewatching them like about a year ago, I was just sitting on my couch like, wow, I remember these movies a lot more fondly than than they really are.
Yeah, yeah. I've had a couple of movies where I've gone back and rewatched them, and it's just been like, oh, this was a lot better when I was like 10.
Oh, for sure. Like, it was like February-ish. I watched every Twilight movie with some coworkers of mine who insisted we see them. But along the way, we watched the parody movie of Twilight called Vampires Suck. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah, so I had only seen it once. I saw it like at an Alamo Draft House with Steven. I don't know if you were with us then.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah, but we saw it in theaters. We were cracking up. We thought it was the funniest thing ever because we were like 11. And then rewatching it this past year, I was like, this is for, you know, 13-year-old boys who hate Twilight to laugh at.
Yeah, it's like all of those like parody movies that they did like mid to late 2000s era.
Yeah, like what, Disaster or Not Another Teen Movie.
Epic Movie.
Oh yeah, epic
superhero movie.
Everyone's trying to be the Zucker Abrams and Zucker of their generation, but you're not going to beat Airplane.
No.
Or Top Secret. No. You're just not going to.
No, no, and that's okay. Nobody can. Like, actually, yeah. Nobody can. I think.
And it's still funny even today.
It is. It's great. I love those.
Sure, but you know what else is funny, Johnny?
Baseball.
You're absolutely right, because yes. I want to open today's episode, before we get into our main story, about all the goofy shit that's been happening, because there's been a lot of it. Are you familiar with the star outfielder Mookie Betts?
I am!
Well, I don't know if you heard, but when him and the Dodgers were on a road trip in Milwaukee, they stayed at a hotel that's supposedly haunted. Teams usually stay there when they're in town for games. I heard Jeff Bagwell talk about he even went hunting for the ghost one time when he was with the Astros, but he never found it.
Aww.
However, Mookie Betts chose not to stay in the hotel and instead rented an Airbnb to avoid any encounters with whatever apparition still walks the halls.
Aww, boo.
Now, he claims that he's not afraid of ghosts, but when he got to the ballpark, the Brewers scoreboard roasted him by saying, "Now Mookie Betts claims to not be afraid of ghosts, but his actions suggest otherwise." And then they changed his walk-up song to the Ghostbusters theme.
Was that this season?
That was this season.
Oh yeah. My god. This season is just like a shitpost.
Honestly... truly is. I mean, Diamondbacks lead their division. When's the last time that happened?
Like 2001. I could look it up.
Yeah, I could look it up.
When Randy Johnson was pitching for the Diamondbacks.
Yeah, when they won their first World Series. I think it's their only World Series. Fastest expansion team to win a championship. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. I think you're right about that.
So that's very silly. Another silly thing is the Kansas City Royals had a walk-off bunt against the White Sox. White Sox having just a fantastic season.
Oh, no, yes. Notes.
But the last time there was a walk-off bunt in regulation was back in the far-off year of 2018.
Oh.
So it's been a minute.
It's been a couple of years. That's not as, like, not as far back as I was expecting, but also there's, like, however many... like cumulative baseball games in a season is like a couple of thousand.
Yeah, already. So while the White Sox were on the poor end of that goofy game, they were on the good end of a different goofy game against another AL Central rival in the Detroit Tigers. Now, the game was in the 10th inning, the score was tied at 1, and the White Sox had bases loaded, and they're the home team, so fly ball wins the game, right? But what happened is the Detroit pitcher, I guess, got crossed up or forgot his release point, and instead of delivering the regular first pitch to Tim Anderson, he threw a 96-mile-an-hour fastball that flew over the catcher's glove and pegged the umpire directly in the face mask.
I remember this.
The ball gets away, and it's still a live ball, so the runner from third comes home and scores a game-winning run 2-1.
Is the umpire part of the field? I guess technically, yeah.
They ruled it a run, and the White Sox won.
How did they score it? Wild pitch?
Yeah, it was a wild pitch, okay. Which brings me to my next point, because so three total runs had scored in the game. Every single run came on a wild pitch, which is to say nobody recorded an RBI this game, and that's the first time that's happened since 1985.
What's going on? What's going on with this season, Ian? Nothing makes sense.
Calamity, insanity, and a bunch of shenanigans.
You know, I couldn't have said it better.
Yeah, a lot of insane stuff. Luis Arez has just decided he's Ted Williams.
You know, and I'm proud of him, but also the Twins traded him last season for some reason. And last season, he batted, like, 370. So, like, what?
Yeah, I think the current Twins hit leader is Carlos Correa. Well, last I saw, it was Carlos Correa with, like, 51. That number will definitely be outdated by the time you're all listening to this. But you know what? Whatever. So that's some goofy stuff. We did have some historical events happen. A lot of pitching milestones. Justin Verlander became the 21st pitcher in MLB history to record a win against all 30 major league teams.
Good for him.
Craig Kimbrell was the 8th pitcher to reach 400 career saves. But do you want to know who the 7th pitcher to reach 400 career saves was?
Tell me.
It was Kenley Jansen, and he also did that this season.
Well, A lot of stuff's happening. A lot of stuff's happening.
Truly a lot of stuff's happening. But my favorite milestone that I want to talk about right now, because we just did an episode on Zach Greinke.
We sure did.
Right after we released his episode, he had another milestone. He became the 5th pitcher in Major League history to strike out 1,000 different batters. The only other pitchers who have done this are some names you might recognize. Nolan Ryan, Randy Johnson, Greg Maddux, and Roger Clemens. So, you know, just some
okay,
some obscure
pitchers.
Company. Yeah, some obscure company he's in up there.
Yeah, they're all right. I bet his response to this was like, yeah.
Oh, Johnny, I have it pulled up right here.
All
right,
let's hear it.
Because he was ecstatic. Quote, "It's pretty neat."
That's about the best compliment that you can get out of Zach Greinke. Just like, yeah, it was cool.
So this is from MLB.com. Yeah, it's pretty neat, Greinke said in his typical matter-of-fact way, saying he's heard about the stat, but it didn't cross his mind Saturday until he got into the dugout. They were a little more excited than normal, said Greinke. I was like, oh yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah, you know, they just kind of swung a lot. It's like, all right, man. Like, okay.
So that's Zach, you know, his typical ecstatic self.
Typical Zach.
And I have one more goofy thing to share before we get into our main story today. Whoopsie. I'm sure you all loved the sound of my phone hitting my desk just then. Johnny, how much do you keep up with Division III college baseball?
None at all. Zero.
Well, I'm going to give you a reason to. Have you heard of, I don't even know how to say this, Misericordia University?
Never heard of it in my life.
Well, they've been kind of dominating Division III college baseball lately because their batters have been hit by pitches 153 times in 52 games.
What?
Which is a pace of 2.94 batters per game, an all-time NCAA record. Oh, and they rode this strategy all the way to the Division III World Series.
What's wrong with them?
They actually, like, train themselves to just stay in the box if there's a pitch coming towards them. And if you don't, your own dugout will yell at you.
So it's like you're getting hazed if you don't take a plunk.
Basically, yeah. There are some exceptions. So, like, if there's a ball coming towards your head, you can duck. If you're known for being a fast runner and there's a ball coming at your feet, you can get out of the way. But otherwise, you just got to stand in there and you got to take
it. Just take it. Just, like, just take the hit.
Yeah, the way they practice it is they'll be on the field practicing and then they'll get in the batter's box and then someone just throws tennis balls at them to train their minds out of getting out of the way of pitches.
That's honestly, like... like kind of funny, but also I'm a little surprised that people haven't done that yet, but also at the major league level these pitches are being thrown at like 100 miles an hour
and they're gonna have better control too. I mean, these are Division III pitchers we're talking about. Not to throw no disrespect, sorry. But, you know, pitches are going to be a little slower, a little more wild. And also, like, doing that in major league level, that's just dangerous.
Yeah, that's just, like, that's just actually dangerous.
So, yeah, and it's what's really funny is it's in the respect of a bunch of other, like, Division III teams who are like, well, you know,
it's like,
they
you
stand
know,
in and take it, so good for them.
If it works, it works.
Yeah, literally, that's how everyone justifies it who's not the Missouri Courtier, whatever. It's a bad name. Anyway, so yeah, if you ever want to get to the World Series, just get hit by baseballs a lot, I guess.
Just get hit by baseballs.
That's today's lesson. But now that we've gotten that out of the way, are you ready for today's story, Johnny?
Oh, I'm stoked. I'm ready.
Okay. I'm glad you are, because I am too. We're actually doing something we haven't done yet, because we've got a lot to talk about, so this is going to be our first two-parter.
Ooh.
Yeah. Also, before we get into this, I just want to issue a trigger warning. We're talking about Ohio today. Again, I know. I'm very sorry.
Ian, I need an intervention for Ian. If someone can call somebody to get Ian to stop talking to me about fucking Ohio, please, anybody, I'm begging you.
I'm sorry. It's where so much goofy shit happens. I got to tell you about it. It's not my fault.
It is, but I'll let this one slide.
Okay. You know what? Fair enough. I put you through a lot on this show, so I understand your frustration, and I apologize. Have you heard of Marge Schott?
No, I have not.
Okay, well, Marge Schott was the owner of the Cincinnati Reds from 1984 till 1999. She is often miscredited as the first woman to own an MLB team, but this is not true. There are lots of examples of women in the late 19th and 20th centuries inheriting teams from their husbands after they passed. And usually what they would do is they would just, like, sell the team or just be, like, super hands-off owners and, you know, just let men run the team.
Mm-hmm.
One notable example of a woman running a baseball team is Helena Britton, who inherited control of the St. Louis Cardinals after her uncle Stanley Robeson passed and left her the controlling interest of the team. She was a daughter of Frank Robeson, who you guys might remember from our the one we did about the Cleveland Spiders and talking about Louis Sakalexis. And the Robeson brothers were the guys who ran the Spiders into the ground
to turn
the St. Louis Browns into the Perfectos, who finished fifth.
Yeah, and, I remember these guys.
Yeah, to this day, Cleveland Spiders, worst single season record. That's Helena. She ran the Cardinals for a while. Marge is also miscredited as the first woman to buy her way into an MLB team, but this is also not true. Joan Whitney Payson was a minority shareholder in the New York Giants in the 1950s. She and another shareholder by the name of M. Donald Grant opposed the Giants moving to San Francisco in 1957, but when the two of them were outvoted by the rest of the ownership team, they sold their shares in the Giants and began working on forming a new franchise. And in 1962, Joan and Donald were awarded an expansion franchise who you know today as the New York Mets.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's been women in baseball. Women have owned teams. Women have, you know, been pretty high up, which is cool. But if you want to get really pedantic about Marge Schott, I guess you could say she's the first woman to buy ownership of a team that already existed. So, let's get into Marge, shall we? Because Marge Schott was born Margaret Unaver on August 18th, 1928 in Cincinnati, Ohio. She was the second of five daughters to her parents, Edward and Charlotte Unaver. Her father, Edward, was a Cincinnati native who became wealthy in the lumber industry. Her mother, Charlotte, was a German immigrant from Hagen, which is a small city in West Germany. Her father was a very strict man, and she described her upbringing as, quote, Achtung German. Whenever Ed needed Marge's mother, he would simply ring a bell to summon her.
Oh, that's... which is, I don't like that.
Yeah, pretty cool. He refused to eat dinner with his children until they were about 4 years old because he thought they were too messy. So Ed desperately wanted to have a son, but only had daughters. Whenever people asked about the sex of his newborn, he would simply reply, quote, a baby.
A baby.
A very warm and loving man, Ed Unaver.
This is like I can just hear this guy. Yes, a baby. Do not talk to me.
I'm trying to sell wood over here. I don't know why I'm doing Russian.
I was trying to do like German, but yeah. I ended up just being like vaguely French. Never mind. This is bad.
It happens. So after daughter number five, Ed gave up trying and decided Marge would be his son instead. I'm going to quote from Sports Illustrated here. Since daddy couldn't have a boy, he treated Marge like one. He called her Butch. She grew up the wisecracking girl daddy took to work whenever he could, the circle-skirted jokester who would bring cigars to slumber parties and smoke them. She was less comfortable around women than men, whom she was learning to love and hate all at once.
Sounds like a problematic childhood, to say the least.
Yeah, Ed is has some very, let's call, classic opinions on women.
Yep.
And we'll get into this more because Ed, you know, really takes Marge under his wing and, you know, shows her, like, you know, how to run a business. But she takes after her father quite a bit into her adulthood. So although she grows up in the Great Depression, her family does pretty well. They live in an upper middle class suburb in Cincinnati. But living through the Great Depression, Marge learns extreme frugality and to never waste anything. Now, if you know anything about history, you know the 1930s go into the 1940s, and some really cool stuff happens in the 40s. So Marge is about 11 when World War II breaks out, and while her mother had five daughters, Charlotte's sister, Marge's aunt, had five sons. This side of the family still lived in Germany, and the boy served in the German army.
Oh, I see. Okay. You know, I was thinking, it's like, they're German, aren't they?
Yeah, they sure are, buddy. Actually, didn't know this until I was researching this. Apparently, Cincinnati has like a large German population. It was a popular spot for Germans to immigrate to back in the day.
Huh, I didn't know that either.
Well, there you go. So now I don't know whether or not Marge's cousins volunteered or were conscripted to be in the German army, but we do know that her aunt would send Marge's family Nazi toy soldiers that Marge and her sisters would play with, along with other Nazi regalia, up to and including a swastika armband.
I feel like the feds would like burn down their house if they had noticed that.
Now, I'm not bringing this up just for the laughs. This, unfortunately, is going to impact some of Marge's opinions going into adulthood, just to give you an idea of where we're going. So Marge graduates from a Catholic high school, and she attends the University of Cincinnati. She attends the university for about 3 years before dropping out to work for her father. Now, Ed wanted Marge to take over the family lumber business, but in 1952, she marries Charles Schott, the son of a wealthy Cincinnati family and heir to their fortune. Now, Charles also served in the U.S. Air Force during World War II, which means it's possible both the Axis and Allies were represented at their wedding. Now, Charlie's father, Walter Schott, was one of the largest auto dealers in Ohio and built his fortune in the 1920s by buying car companies that were going under and liquidating their inventories, an idea that would inspire Marge later. They also had a holding company called Schott Co., which held several entities, including manufacturing plants, business real estate, hotels, and, quote, a firm rated as one of the largest growers of fruits and vegetables in the nation. I don't know what that means, to be honest.
They just have their fingers in everything, huh?
Yeah, dude, this is like classic old money family, super rich. Mm. Much like her father, Ed, Walter takes Marge under his wing and instills his business philosophies on her. She would sit in on board meetings with him, but wasn't allowed to speak while the meeting was in session. The business strategies she learns from these two men largely seem to be how tax shelters and loopholes work. The biggest thing she learns from Ed and Walter is cutting expenses. And she's going to take this to an extreme, but we'll talk about that later. Sadly, Marge and Charlie's marriage wasn't a loving one. According to her biography, quote, Charles was a hopeless alcoholic who left her alone on their wedding night to play cards and left her alone hundreds of nights after that. Play cards is also, that was Charlie's euphemism for going out drinking.
I'm going to go out and play some cards.
Yeah, we're not playing cards. Their friends said the two were usually belittling each other, especially when Charlie's drinking got worse after the death of Walter. Marge seemed to have gotten along better with Walter than she did Charlie. The two never had children, which would be one of Marge's biggest regrets. She was later quoted saying, I just don't think I did my job. In my day, girls were raised to raise kids, and I didn't do it. Now, Marge and Charlie tried to have kids, but for whatever reason, Marge wasn't getting pregnant. Marge says she hired several doctors in an attempt to have children, and claimed that one doctor she saw even treated the Shah of Iran, which, okay.
What?
I don't know how you have that connection.
What?
She also claims this doctor nearly killed her with, like, whatever mystic medicine he was using. I don't know.
What?
I couldn't find a lot of background on this, but she does claim this.
All right. Maybe she's got a, you know, little delusional. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know, man. They considered adoption, but for a bunch of reasons, they never did. Marge and Charlie were together for 16 years until Charlie died of a heart attack in 1968 at the age of 42.
Yikes.
It's alleged that he was found in the bathtub of his mistress. Now, Marge has never confirmed this, but has also never denied it. Whenever someone asks her about it, she either dodges the question or claims she doesn't know where Charlie's body was found. So now she's a widow. She never remarries. In place of children of her own, she had other people's kids and her dogs. Marge loved all animals, but dogs especially, and St. Bernards in particular. Sports Illustrated said she had 22 St. Bernards over the course of her life.
All right, this woman is a supervillain. I'm calling it right now. This is like Lex Luthor owning a baseball team.
Oh, buddy. Oh, we're going to get into that. Don't you worry.
No!
So... later, when she owns the Reds, she would let her dogs and fans' kids run around on the field before games and love signing autographs for them in the stands. While she loved her employees' kids, she didn't love her employees. Quote, it was weird, says one former marketing employee. She was great to our families, absolutely terrific, but she treated us like shit. Now, Sports Illustrated corroborates this by saying, quote, whatever generous spirit there is inside Shot flickers out when she sits behind that owner's desk. So, like, following Charlie's death... Sorry, go ahead.
She just, like has an iron fist over this.
Oh, yeah, dude. I mean, we'll get into the why and also all the awful and sometimes funny things she does.
All right.
But, yeah. Actually, you know what? Let's talk about that. So, following Charlie's death, Marge takes over the car dealership the family owned. Charlie's uncle tried to buy Marge out of her shares of the company, but she refused to sell and instead chose to get heavily involved in the dealership. It's thought she did this as a fuck you to Charlie, who didn't want Marge involved in any Shot family business. But she runs this car dealership and all of... I mean, Shot Co., basically, in tandem with a guy by the name of John Borcherding. Now, John was a close friend of Charlie's, and he was a guy who mostly ran things while Charlie was away on drinking binges. Marge and John only worked together for about a year until John gets fed up and literally storms out of the dealership. And it's one of those, like, kind of cheesy movie moments where John is, like, storming out of the building and Marge is like, if you walk out that door, you're fired. And John is like, okay, and just leaves. So, as I'm sure you can imagine, Charlie was a pretty hands-off owner since he was usually too drunk to run things. But when he was sober, both him and John were good bosses who took care of their employees. Marge was the opposite. She was incredibly hands-on and focused almost solely on cutting costs. John tells several stories of Marge griping at him over phone bills, even if the calls were being made to one of her other businesses. At the brick company she owned, Marge fired an employee who had been with the company a long time because he was making $30,000 a year, which is good money for 1968.
Yeah, that's really good.
And so she fires him and replaces him with someone else to do the same job for less money. That's how she awards loyalty. which she demands too.
Yeah, the ultimate capitalist.
Yeah, it's cool. Following John's departure, there was a lengthy legal battle for Marr to take full ownership of Schott Buick. Now, there was a lot of debate over whether or not a woman with no experience in the auto industry could own a car dealership, but she eventually wins, making her the first woman to own a General Motors dealership in a major U.S. city. 2 years later, she would also be the first woman to be named to the Board of Trustees in the Cincinnati Chamber of Commerce.
She's got a lot going for her.
Yeah, it's like she kind of is a trailblazer and a pioneer for women. It just sucks that, I mean, there's a lot of these types of characters around where, like, take Ellen DeGeneres, who was like one of the first, like, well, probably like the first, like, openly, you know, out lesbian person on TV, which, I, you know, is a good thing, but both her and Marge are just like the worst people.
Yeah.
You know? And it just sucks that, you know, bad people do these good things. So now in charge, Marge was running a successful business because, like, they were making money, but not because, like, she had good business practices. She's just cutting overhead everywhere.
Yeah. She's just like, how can we make this cheaper?
Yeah, exactly. And all of her employees hated her. She would scream at them and berate them, and there's several instances her salesman shared about Marge sabotaging sales on cars. So her father taught her to never be cheated, but she took this to the extreme. In her own words, she was a woman in a man's world, and thus didn't trust her salesman to not fuck over her or her customers. So it was common for her to talk people out of buying certain cars after a salesman had already been working them.
Oh my god.
In one instance, a salesman got someone to buy one of their cars for the sticker price, which is what you're supposed to do as a salesman.
Yeah.
But when Marge found out about this, she called the customer who bought it and told them, oh, you bought this for too much money. We're giving you a partial refund. And also took away the salesman's commission.
What the fuck? What?
Yep. Yeah, counterintuitive to making money.
Yeah, that's like the... I thought that was the opposite of what she wanted.
Yeah, it really doesn't make sense. But yeah, she just thinks her salesmen are just being greedy and fucking over her customers. And so she's stepping in and being like, no, I'll take care of you. Yeah. And so she thinks she's establishing a business relationship that way. One of her salesmen even takes her to court after his third and final firing because Marge hadn't paid him commission on 20 sales.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
How is this guy, like, surviving?
Well, he goes to a different dealership and he barely makes any money from the lawsuit because she still manages to get off with paying him, like, underpaying him on commission, and after legal fees, he did end up in the green, but, like, barely. But he said, he was like, I don't care. It was about just, like, the principle of the matter. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, salesmen learned that if they made money on a car sale, to not let Marge find out about it. I also read a funny story where there was a woman in a red coat who was at the dealership because she was having her car serviced. And it was winter in Cincinnati, so she didn't want to hang out outside, obviously. So she comes into the dealership and she's looking around the showroom floor just to pass the time while her car's being serviced. And Marge sees her walking around the floor from her office. And so Marge gets on the intercom and is like, salesman to the floor to, you know, help this woman. Mm-hmm. But like everyone else knows she wasn't there to buy a car. So her head salesman comes out and is like waving at her, like, from the floor, getting Marge's attention, being like, no, she's not a customer, she's waiting for her car. But Marge isn't listening, and she's, like, screaming over the intercom. She's like, someone help the woman in the red coat! Help the woman in the red coat! And this woman got so embarrassed by what was going on, she went back outside and waited for her car in the cold. And then when it was ready, she drove off the lot and never came back.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
So, in another cost-cutting measure, she demanded that employees turn off the lights in their offices, even if they were just going down the hall for, like, a second. Like, if you're not in your office, the light cannot be on for any reason. She would also turn off the heat in the winter and the AC in the summer. So, yeah, that showroom floor was always very good to be on. She did this with all of her businesses in town. Employees at the car dealership would leave notes on the computers telling Marge not to turn them off, but she would do it anyway. although she would admit that doing so would make the computer, quote, lose all the thingies on the screen.
Lose all the thingies on the screen. Very cool, Marge. One.
Yeah, I wonder how that happens.
One other good reason to not live in Cincinnati.
So the mood at her businesses always dampened when she showed up, and employees would avoid her in order to not get screamed at over just whatever she felt like screaming at you for, usually something trivial.
Yeah.
When she was making her rounds to check on her businesses, employees would call ahead to her next stop to let them know she was coming.
It's like, hey, look out. Here comes Marge.
Yeah, they're like, hey, she's on her way, so, you know, turn off the AC or whatever. Oh, there was a funny thing I read. One of the car salesmen, like, they got the warning that she was coming, and so they turned off the heat. But when she got there, there was still some residual heat in the building, so she went to go turn it off. But then she gets to, like, the thermostat, and it sees it's already off already, and then she was, like, walking around all confused for, like, 20 minutes.
She's like, why is it so warm in here? What's going on? Am I, like, yeah.
So, while Marge spends the 70s running her businesses, the Cincinnati Reds spent the decade dominating the newly formed National League West. As you know, the western city of Cincinnati.
Yeah, very western.
They shared this division with the Houston Astros and also the western city of Atlanta, Georgia.
That's NL West.
Remember that?
That's right. NL West was like really fucked up.
Yeah, when the Dodgers and the Braves were in the same division.
Yeah.
Oh, do you want to know a fucked up geography fact?
Yeah, let's hear it.
The city of Atlanta is further west than Detroit.
What?
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Yeah, pull it. Google that shit.
No,
pull up a Google Maps.
No, it's not.
Yes, I know. I had this reaction too.
What? Here.
It's a fact that shouldn't be true, but it is. It's terrible. And I encourage you to do this as well, listener. Open Google Maps or whatever you want.
This is wrong.
It's the
this is fake.
Yeah, I know, but there it is.
Hey.
I told you it's a fucked up geography
Cincinnati fact. Is technically farther west than Atlanta.
Well, there you go.
No, this sucks. I hate this. All right, anyway, go on.
So throughout the 1970s, the Reds won the division 6 times. They earned 4 National League pennants and back-to-back World Series titles in 1975 and 76. This dominance earned them the team nickname, the Big Red Machine.
Yeah, they had so many good players on those teams.
Yeah, I mean, that's guys like, I mean, Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Joe Morgan, Ken Griffey Sr.
Yeah,
it's
so good.
All legends. All of them should be in the Hall of Fame, but that's for another episode.
It'll just be me yelling about Pete Rose for like an hour and a half.
I'm definitely going to wait to do that just so we don't immediately talk about Ohio again. So the Reds manager for most of the decade was Sparky Anderson, who remains the winningest manager in the history of the franchise to this day, with 863 wins to 586 losses.
Damn.
Which is good for a win-loss percentage just under 600. He's at 596.
Dang, that's really good.
Yeah, dude. In their back-to-back World Series winning seasons, they won 210 games to just 114 losses.
Man.
Almost doubled.
I know, it's crazy.
So, the man who built this team was Bob Housem. He became the general manager of the Reds in 1967 after previous owner Bob DeWitt sold the team to an 11-man ownership team. Of these 11 guys, none of them had any real baseball experience or knowledge, but were smart enough to hire someone who did. So they offered Bob a 3-year contract and complete control of the team. Now, Housem had built a career as a successful minor league executive, twice winning executive of the year in both single-A and triple-A baseball. Before coming to the Reds, he had spent 2 years as the GM of the St. Louis Cardinals, where he helped build what would become their World Series teams in 67 and 68.
Mm.
Though, of course, Bob was gone by the time this had happened. Now, from his time running minor league teams, Bob knew how to run every aspect of a baseball team and was very good at hiring a front office to support his vision for a franchise. The big things he does when he comes to Cincinnati is expand their farm system and hire a small army of scouts. He also puts an emphasis on advanced ticket sales and improving ballpark maintenance. Because, you know, you got to take care of the place where you play.
Yeah, you do.
Make it a good experience for the fans. What a crazy idea. So his farm system and scout hiring is perhaps what he's most well known for. Bob made it a point to take care of his employees, but especially his scouts. He made sure his scouts always had enough resources to maintain their vehicles on long road trips, and wanted his scouts to have spacious enough cars to fit baseball equipment. He would treat employees to dinner in, you know, his general manager's box at the stadium. And when it came Christmas time, he would advance everyone's paychecks so they had extra money to spend for the holidays.
Sounds like a good
just
guy.
All in all, yeah, just like just a dream of a boss to have.
Yeah.
You know? He wanted everyone in the organization to feel included and wanted, and in return, everyone enjoyed working for him and were actually motivated to perform well.
Crazy how that works.
Yeah. Yeah, weird how being a good person to people who work for you give you a lot of good work in return. Again, wild to think about. So another one of Bob's superpowers was player evaluation. He had an almost supernatural ability to trade away players who were becoming fading stars in exchange for rising stars. His deals were almost always met with confusion and criticism, but would usually end up great for his team. For example, he traded star center fielder Vada Pinson to St. Louis, his old team, in exchange for outfielder Bobby Talon and relief pitcher Wayne Granger. Pinson would have a decent career after leaving Cincinnati, but his bat was starting to lose its power. Meanwhile, Talon's bat became a key weapon during the Big Red Machine years, and Granger would be one of the Reds' most effective relievers for the next three seasons. So, the Reds stay just shy of 90 wins for his first 3 years with the team before firing manager Dave Bristol and replacing him with, guess who, Sparky Anderson. Once again, this decision was met with confusion, and once again, Bob was proved right when Sparky went on to become one of the greatest managers in the history of the game. In just his first season with the team in 1970, Spark led the Reds to 102 wins before falling to the Orioles in that year's World Series.
Damn.
And he's the best. Bob knew it.
Yep, he's the best.
So, the owner of the Reds during this era was Louis Nippert, who was about as hands-off an owner could be, and literally let Bob run the show. These two men oversaw arguably the best team in the 1970s until Bob retired from his general manager role in 1978, but stayed on with the team as a consultant. In his place, Bob instated his special assistant, Dick Wagner, who he hired a decade earlier as the new general manager.
That's a baseball name.
Yeah, right. Terrific baseball name, Dick Wagner.
Dick Wagner.
So, sadly, Wagner was no Howsam. Wagner became something of a villain in Cincinnati after firing Sparky Anderson and allowing key players to leave the team via trade or free agency. The Reds would win the division in 1979, but got swept out of the NLCS by the Pirates, who would win the World Series that year, and they have not won another title since. Sorry, Pittsburgh. The team then went from mediocre in 1980 to one of the worst in baseball, losing 101 games in 1982. They would have been the worst in baseball that year had the Twins not lost 102 games.
There's always someone worse.
There's life lesson. No matter how bad you are, someone is always worse.
I always feel bad because we're gonna go back to the Mariners because I just love wallowing. But I watch Seattle play and it's like, damn, we're terrible. And then I look and it's like, well, could be the A's.
You could be the Royals.
You could be the Royals. I think
who are worse than the A's?
They
somehow.
Are. They actually are.
Oh, it's terrible. So, Louis Nippert sold the Reds in 1980 to brothers Jim and Bill Williams, two limited partners in the organization. But for whatever boring business reasons, there was still one share of the team that was up for grabs. Needing a buyer, the Williams brothers brainstormed and thought of a local Cincinnati car dealer, Marge Schott. Now, Marge and the Williams brothers had known each other for years, as the Williams brothers were friends of Charlie's, and Marge had been a lifelong Reds fan, a native Cincinnati, you know, citizen, so it made sense. And when they approached her asking if she would buy the share in the team, she said yes, becoming a limited partner in the Reds in 1981.
So it begins.
Yeah, so truly, the origins are so humble and unassuming. Because Marge was a quiet and detached partner when she joined the organization. She rarely attended meetings, and when she did, she would never say anything. But she would fly banners at Riverfront Stadium advertising her car dealership. During one bad stretch for the Reds, she flew different banners that asked Pete Rose, Joe Morgan, and Tony Perez to come help the team. The Williams brothers weren't too fond of this stunt and just a lot of things she would do, and would pull Marge aside and be like, hey, this is kind of in poor taste.
That's like, you know, it's like, hey, Ichiro, can you come back and help Seattle hit the ball?
Yeah, just like openly admitting your team sucks.
Yeah.
Ownership team really shouldn't be doing that. So among the partners, Marge never really fit in. She mostly got along with the wife of another partner, but I mean, she really wasn't good friends with anyone else. However, in 1982 and 83, the team was sliding, and so was fan attendance. And even though Marge was something of a black sheep, all partners agreed the team needed help and a change needed to be made. So the Williams brothers fired Dick Wagner during the 1983 season, and in doing so, trigger a clause in one of their consultants' contracts. See, Bob Housham spent most of his consulting time looking after the Reds' farm system when he was called back to the front office, as his contract stipulated that if the general managers let go, he would have to either A, help the team find a new one, or B, act as GM until a new one was found. Now, honestly, the Williams brothers just wanted Bob to just take his old job back. And even though he didn't want to, Bob agreed to come back for 3 years, but wanted to leave after two, if possible.
It's like, I'll do it, but I won't like it.
Yeah, he was like, I really don't want to, but he's like, I already did this for a long time. It's a stressful job.
Yeah, no kidding. It is.
And Bob wasn't in bad health at the time, but not in the greatest health. He was like having back issues and just enjoyed not being GM anymore.
Understandable.
So his return boosted morale all throughout the Reds organization. One box office employee said, quote, it was like the cavalry came back to save you. He's like the Rohirrim, or no, he's like Gandalf bringing the Rohirrim to Helm's Deep, you know. So upon his return, Bob quickly endeared himself to the front office by raising everyone's salaries. So, you know.
That's why they like this guy, huh?
Really hard to dislike Bob, honestly. So he evaluates the 1983 team, and at the end of the season, he replaces manager Russ Nixon with Vern Rapp, which are, I don't know, decent baseball names.
Russ Nixon, yeah.
And Vern Rapp with two P's.
Oh, the two P's. That actually, you know, that's a pretty good baseball name.
Yeah, how many Verns do you know? What is that even short for? I'm going to Google that right now.
Vernacular? I don't know.
What's Vern short for?
I don't know if it's short for anything.
Oh, Vernon.
Vernon, okay.
Or Laverne, okay. Vern. hey Vern, how you doing?
Vern is like Vern is either like an English name, like you'd hear in Britain, or you'd hear it in like the Midwest and nowhere else.
The only two spots where you find it. I just love to see that heat map. That would just look really
the Vern
funny.
Heat map of the world.
Yeah, the Vern heat map. Yeah. So Vern was one of Bob's favorite AAA managers. He thought he was great at player development and getting them ready for the big leagues. So, now naturally hired him to be the big league manager. Unfortunately, this didn't work out for the team, and Vern was gone before the end of the 1984 season. But Bob had another idea. Bring Reds legend and hitting champion Pete Rose back to Cincinnati. See, Pete was a bench player for the Montreal Expos at the time, which is strange. You know, it's like a bunch of famous players like have short stints with teams that everyone forgets about. It's like when Ken Griffey Jr. played for the White Sox. You're like, what? That happened?
What? Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. And just like seeing like pictures of them in those uniforms that you would never associate with them.
Yeah. That's how I felt about Ichiro wearing a Yankees jersey.
Oh yeah, Yankees, Marlins yeah. was
Marlins.
I know he's with the Marlins for a while, but still that just doesn't stand out to me.
No. Or like Alex Rodriguez with the Rangers.
Oh yeah.
That was like that's kind of messed up. That's messed up.
So, yeah, Pete's playing in Montreal, and Bob wanted him to come back and manage the Reds. Pete agreed to do so, but on one condition, that he be a player as well as the manager. See, Pete knew he was within striking distance of Ty Cobb's hit record of 4,189, and he didn't want to retire without breaking it. Well, we'll talk more about this in our second part, but I use the number 4,189 here because that's the one that's on Baseball Reference. Mm-hmm. It was previously thought to be 4,191, but we'll get to that later. So that's why I said the number I did.
Okay.
So yeah, Pete wants to play. Bob wasn't totally on board with Pete playing, but he accepted, figuring that having Pete on the field would at least sell more tickets, which the Reds desperately needed.
It's like, we suck. We need more money, please.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. So Pete takes over player manager duties for the remainder of 1984. He would play until 1986, but stayed out as manager until 1989. Additionally, Bob signed reigning National League MVP Dave Parker for the 1984 season, and by the end of the season, top Reds prospect Eric Davis would reach the bigs as well. So, they would finish in fifth place that year, but things were looking up for the Reds. The future was bright. So, going into 1985, Bob felt he had accomplished what he needed to and asked the Williams brothers to return to consulting, and they obliged his request. One of Bob's final moves as acting GM was to bring in Bill Burgish from the Yankees to take over as a full-time general manager. As Bob was returning to consulting, the Williams brothers were also stepping down from their roles as team owners. They first tried selling their controlling shares to limited partner Carl Linder, but talks between them stalled and no sale was ever made. So, like, they want to sell to a limited partner, which makes sense, you know, if everyone's already been on that team, it's just easy to sell. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows, like, the vision of the club, right? But outside of the limited partners of the club, only two serious offers came in. Former commissioner of baseball and ex-Kentucky governor, and get ready for this name, Johnny, Happy Chandler.
Happy Chandler, yo!
It's Happy Chandler, baby!
That might be one of the best names we've heard on this show.
Yeah, terrific baseball name.
Excellent baseball name. And Kentucky Top governor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how you were.
How do you go? How do you
commissioner
do that?
Of baseball and ex Kentucky governor.
That's crazy.
So Happy Chandler partners up with the owner of the Louisville Cardinals, who are a minor league team. His name was A. Ray Smith. So they make an offer, and the other offer came from two guys who were both named Bill. There was Bill DeWitt Jr., whose dad previously owned the Reds. We mentioned him earlier. And Bill Reich. I don't know. It's R-E-I-K. Reich? I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I think it's Reich. So Bill Reich would later become a limited partner. But Chandler and Smith offered $25 million for the team that the two Bills matched. Now, since the Bills were the more local duo, the Williams brothers were considering selling to them until another limited partner spoke up with an offer. Marge Schott.
Oh, no.
Now, throughout the selling process, Marge had been in touch with Bill Williams about buying the necessary shares to acquire ownership. She was hesitant to buy, as she didn't know anything about baseball and wasn't sure where she was going to get the money. Jim Williams was unsure she would even scrounge together enough money to buy, but in the end, she did. Marge takes out a loan of over $10 million and buys 7 more shares in the team for $11.2 million. Well, she would sell 2 shares back to 2 other partners, so her net spending, she basically bought the team for a little less than $9 million.
Man.
Yeah.
That's like dirt.
Yeah, I mean, almost nothing.
Yeah.
Especially for, I mean, 1980s money. They're in a recession, bro.
Yeah, I know.
Marge would announce her purchase of the Reds on December 21st, 1984. She called it her Christmas gift to the city and declared herself, quote, the savior of Cincinnati baseball. See, Marge was under the impression that the Williams brothers were going to sell the team to an out-of-towner and the team was going to be moved out of Cincinnati, because it was public knowledge that Happy Chandler and the two Bills were interested in buying the team. But
it could have been... it could have been moved to Louisville. They could have done that.
Maybe. Well, I'm going to quote from Bill Williams here.
Okay.
I have no idea where she gets this impression. The only person who had any real hard interest was Happy Chandler. He called and came up and we had lunch, and he said he'd like to buy the ball club. I said, Happy, if we sell the team, we want to keep it in Cincinnati ownership. He said, oh, well, hell, we're just across the river. We're practically Cincinnati. I said, no. You're too far down the river. We're going to keep this in Cincinnati. And according to another limited partner, George Strike, also pretty good baseball name, there was never any indication or fear that the Reds might be leaving Cincinnati.
Damn.
Which makes sense. I mean, the Cincinnati Reds are the oldest franchise in the history of baseball. There's just so much tradition seeped there. The team is never going to move. It's just not going to happen.
Damn. I could have. I had some hope that,
yeah, sorry,
that Louisville would have had baseball again.
You also just don't want to talk about Ohio.
Don't want to talk about Ohio anymore.
So, upon Marge's acquisition of the team, Bill gave her two pieces of advice. One, shut the fuck up. And two, just let your general manager run the team. Just stay quiet. Let your GM do what he needs to do. Because everyone knew, including Marge, that she did not know anything about baseball. So, at her press conference to announce her purchase of the team, she brought her St. Bernard Shotzi to the event, which drew mixed reactions from members of the organization. Bill Burgish called Marge while the press conference was still going on to congratulate her. Now, he didn't know the conference was going on, he just called her. But Marge, of course, did know the conference was going on, and she just takes the call in the middle of the press conference. And, you know, they talk briefly, and she thanks him for the call. And after they hung up, someone asked Marge who she was talking to. She replied, "Oh, that was our general manager, Whatchamadoodle."
Whatchamadoodle?
She did not know his name.
Good, great job, Marge. Really, really stellar, outstanding job on this one.
Yeah, she really doesn't know anyone's name, and we'll talk more about that later. So it would take Major League Baseball 7 weeks to approve of the sale to Marge. Then Commissioner Peter Ueberroth thought the club was too hasty in selecting a new owner and wanted them to contemplate their decision more thoroughly. Now, Peter said this had nothing to do with Marge's character because he really didn't know Marge that well at the time. He just genuinely thought, like, you guys kind of found new ownership pretty quickly. I just want y'all to be really sure this is what you want. But people were impatient, especially Bob Housem. So Bob spoke with Peter during a baseball meeting in New York and urged him to expedite the process so the Reds wouldn't be stuck in like a weird limbo state since they like technically don't have an owner right now. He does the same thing with National League president, and this is a really good name, Chubb Feeney.
Chubb Feeney. Man.
Chubb Feeney.
We got a
baby.
Lot of good names this time.
So, not long after, on February 7th, the sale is approved and Marge officially became the new owner of the Cincinnati Reds. Later, Bob Housem looked back on his push to get Marge in the owner's chair and said, quote, "It was the worst mistake I ever made in baseball."
Oh.
And that, Johnny, is where we are going to pick up next time.
Ooh, I'm actually really excited for the rest of this because it's just like, this is all the buildup and you kind of get all of the like, the stuff that leads up to Marge owning the Reds, and then I can't wait for just the inevitable, well, actually, I don't know if it's inevitable, but the, like, crash and burn and downfall of this, because I'm sure it's going to happen, because all of these episodes end one way or another in that fashion.
Well, you're correct, and in a sense, I've kind of already told you the story, because basically what she does with her car dealership, she does to the Reds as well. In terms of just mistreatment of employees and cutting costs, and I'm still writing the second part, but it's it gets pretty bad.
I'm so excited. I'm glad that this is a two-parter and not just one long one, because it leaves the, like, suspense still there.
Yeah, there's just too much to cover, because, I mean, when she owns the Reds, that's really the meat of the story, but to set it all up properly and talk about her ownership of the Reds would have taken forever, and I didn't want either of us to be sitting here with with a two-and-a-half-hour episode or whatever. And I don't want to edit all that much. So
understandable. Very understandable.
So, yeah, that's why we're splitting this up. And I'm a genius storyteller, so that's why I left it on this cliffhanger. But yeah, we'll get into it, and it's a doozy, man. I'm going to apologize in advance to you.
Well, I'm ready.
It's pretty bad. And I guess, you know what, I'm going to give a shout out to future listeners, because depending on when you're listening to this, you might not even have to wait. You can just fire up the next episode right now if you want to.
Yeah, good for you.
But as of right now, the initial release of this episode, you're going to have to wait. So there, okay? Anything you want to talk about before we hit the dusty trail here?
I just hope that the story after this doesn't take place in Ohio.
Marge lived and died in Ohio, so
not the next episode, oh, but one that's not about Marge.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, okay, yeah. I'm sorry, my brain is small, and you know, as a favor to you, I will make sure our next story doesn't even mention Ohio.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah. Oh, actually, I have a pretty good idea for another one that you'll enjoy. but yeah, thank you for bearing with me as we once again spend our time in Ohio. Well, thank you for listening, everybody, and get excited for part two. You're gonna love it, I promise.
I'm gonna enjoy it, I know that's for sure. We'll probably pick back up after the All-Star break.
Oh yeah, that's coming up real soon.
Yeah, that's like in a little over two weeks
about. Yeah. Yeah, depending on how quickly I get the next episode written, these might be coming out after the All-Star break, but I hope we can at least, I'm hoping that we can at least record the second part before that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, so far in what I have for part two, in just the first year of her owning the Reds is several pages.
So. And she...
Oh, boy.
She gets sole ownership of the Reds in what year again?
So she buys it at the end of 1984, okay. But she doesn't technically become like the formal owner until 1985. Okay. So kind of that like period between December of 84 and February of 85, like the Reds technically didn't have an owner, and that's that weird limbo state that Bob was trying to get them out of. So yeah, it's like technically 1984, and then... Yeah, 85 is her first season as the owner. And yeah, she owns this team until 1999.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Okay.
Whew, okay. All right. Time to go back to reading about this lady. All right. Thank you again for listening. Follow the show on social media. Share us around. That just makes me feel good. Leave us a review because that helps out. And, you know, just be good to your fellow man. In a world of Marge shots, be a Bob Housem. How about that?
Amen.
Amen. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye.
See you guys.